Betty kept her small collection of coins, gained from running the ferry, in the canvas bag which had once protected her corn. And one morning, when she felt satisfied that she had saved enough, she asked a farmer who was heading downriver to the Rood store at Austin's headquarters at San Felipe to perform a commission for her. And 2 months later, a man on horseback arrived bearing a small keg of nails and a long package. It was a pit saw with two big handles. And when it was assembled, she told her husband, "We'll rip us some planks and build us a real house. I'll live underground no more." The crunk was essential to her plans, for she needed his strength to dig a pit deep enough for a man to stand in. And now, cut the tallest, thickest tree trunk you can move to the pit. And when it was hauled across the pit, she climbed down with instructions to her men. "I'll do the dirty work, you do the strong." Grasping the lower handle, she pushed the saw up, while one of the men standing astride the log topside pulled it into cutting position. Then the men bore down while Mattie pulled. And in this laborious way, with sawdust in her face day after day, she supervised the cutting of the planks needed for her house. She never complained, for she kept before her the vision of the home that was to be. And when she felt she had enough planks, she climbed out of her pit, dragooned two travelers to stay as helpers, and started building her house. At various places in Texas, she had seen the type of house she wanted. It had come west from South Carolina and Georgia, and provided an excellent device for surviving in a hot or humid climate. "It's called a dog run," Mattie explained to the crunk, who did much of the heavy work. "We build a little square house here, leave 17 feet open space, then build another, same size, over here." "Why here? Here?" the Indian asked. And she said, "One house sleeping, one house living." And he said, "Work too damn much." Then she explained that the two squares would not remain separated. "Up there, one long roof over everything. Down here, one long porch, end to end." "In between what?" the cronk asked. And she said, "Place for cool breezes. Place for dogs to run in the day, sleep at night." He then wanted to know what the porch was for, and she said, "Work done, we watch sunset. Travelers come, they sleep on porch." And he said approvingly, "Damn good." When it was completed, with liberal use of improvised wattle and vine walls that would serve until more planks could be cut, Mattie waited till Reverend Harrison came by on his way to Stephen Austin's headquarters. "Will you bless this house, Reverend?" He did, praying that the Quimpers would enjoy years of happiness and prosperity in it. But some weeks later, when Harrison was returning from his talk with Austin, he appeared at the door of the house unannounced, to find Jubal and two travelers playing cards and swigging from a jug of muscadine wine. Mattie saw the flare of disgust that crossed his face as he said, "Do you allow gaming in a house I dedicated to the Lord?" "I do," she said. "Jesus drank wine." Coming close to pronouncing anathema upon her, he cried, "You and your husband, and all of them, stand in danger of being rejected of God. Gaming and drinking, they'll be the ruin of Texas." Jubal had always known it was bound to happen, and now it was upon him. Reverend Harrison and Father Clooney had arrived at the same time, and some kind of ugly confrontation seemed inescapable. The Protestant clergyman came first, on a surreptitious round of Methodist prayer meetings, at which he delivered agitating news about events in Mexico City, the capital of the country. "They threw out the Spanish, as we know. But before long they invited that fool Iturbide to make himself emperor, and what American would want to live under the dictates of an emperor?" A man who had traveled in Mexico said dryly, "They shot him last year." But this did not alter Harrison's diatribe. Each day men like Iturbide remain in control, the yoke of Rome is fastened ever more tightly about our necks. Each day we do not resist, we become more surely the vassals of the Pope, and I can feel in my bones the constant loss of freedom we're undergoing. We're in peril, and we must bind ourselves ever closer, or we shall lose our freedom, our church, and our understanding of God. Night after night he conducted his frenzied meetings, until he had many of the farmers almost prepared to take up arms to defend their rights. And he was equally persuasive with women, for he spoke eloquently of what would happen if their children never learned the beneficent lessons of Protestantism. "Do you want your daughters to become nuns, locked away in some convent, the prey of priests, never to know the blessings of a true Christian home?" He also frightened them with graphic descriptions of what it meant to worship regularly in the Catholic mode. And he nailed down his preaching with a plea which came from the heart. "The Protestant Church is the true Church of Jesus Christ. He called it forth. He ordained us to do his great work on earth, and we must remain faithful to his precepts." He was effective because his listeners, hungry for moral guidance, always knew where he stood. He was for the New Testament, morality, and Methodism. He was against Rome, alcohol, sexual indulgence, dancing, and any kind of irreverence. But in this summer of 1825, he added a bold new dimension to his preaching. "I cannot believe that the good Christians who came to Texas from Kentucky and Tennessee will long continue under the tyranny of Mexico and Rome." And once he said this, he realized its implications. "When that joyous day comes, we'll join the United States." He justified this treasonous behavior as faith plus patriotism. He was conducting a secret meeting for elders at the Quimper's Inn late one afternoon, with some 20 farmers surrounding him, when a watcher, posted to detect any approach of Mexican soldiers, ran in. "Father Clooney coming on his mule." And when the conspirators peered out, they saw the familiar figure of the Irish priest, older now and thinner, riding up to the porch. They had no opportunity to disperse before he dismounted, brushed the dust from his black vestments, and entered. One glance at the unusual number of guests and the tall minister who commanded them satisfied him as to what was happening, but he affected not to know. Greeting Reverend Harrison warmly, as if he were no more than some farmer he had met on the Trinity, he smiled at the others he had known before, and said to the strangers, "I don't believe I know you. Father Clooney of Ballycloony, County Clare in Ireland, appointed by the Mexican government to be vicar of this parish." Having put the conspirators at ease, he then offended their leaders by asking Matty Quimper, "Could a perishing pilgrim have a wee nip?" And when she provided one, Reverend Harrison glared at the disgraceful cup as if he wished to turn its contents into vitriol. Father Clooney was filled with news acquired at the Assembly of the Catholic Clergy recently convened in San Antonio, and although his personal recollections of that meeting were not altogether pleasant, he was eager to share the substantial news which came from it. His unhappiness stemmed from the way he had been treated, as an interloping Irishman who spoke abominable Spanish, by the more austere Spanish priests who had been trained in Spain, and the older Mexican fathers with their education in Mexico City and Querétaro. They had scorned him as a village nothing, a cactus priest of the bayous, not really one of them and not to be trusted. They had heard of his excessive drinking and of his casual approach to conversion, and many suspected that he was a secret agent sent by the American government to prepare the way for a Yankee takeover. But since none of them would have dreamed of moving one step north from San Antonio or of serving in wilderness areas like the banks of the Trinity, they were content to let this renegade Irishman do their pastoral work for them. His latest experience with these arrogant superiors had not been pleasant, but it had been instructive. And now he gushed forth the resounding news. As you've surely heard, there was a wonderful revolution in Mexico last year. Emperor Iturbide was overthrown by a group of sterling patriots, and the old viciousness has been cleansed away. A new Mexico, a new life for all of us. The hero of the change is a most splendid man, devout, loyal, brave. General Antonio López de Santa Anna. You'll hear much of him in the glorious days ahead, for he brings freedom and distinction to the word patriot. But the excelling news is that Santa Anna and his associates have given us a new constitution. And I promise you that in Mexican history, the date 1824 will become as famous as 1776 is in your America. Because the Constitution of 1824 is a noble document, assuring us the freedoms we've sought. It gives Coahuila y Texas its own state government. It protects us. It guarantees a permanent republic. And it erases all memories of Emperor Iturbide and his follies. What a glorious day for Mexico! His listeners soon caught the infection of his enthusiasm. For if what he said about the new constitution was true, most frictions with the central government would be eliminated, and Texas, under its own regional government, would have a chance to forge ahead. But Reverend Harrison had a pertinent question. What does the new rule say about religion? And Father Clooney answered forthrightly, "It says that the official religion of Mexico must forever be Roman Catholicism." "And will the official church be supported by our tax money?" Harrison asked. And again the round-faced priest gave a straight answer. "The church will be supported, as before, by the public treasury." "If that is so, men who love freedom must oppose your new constitution." It was now dusk, and in the crowded dog run, two men of radically opposing views faced each other. Reverend Harrison, tall, austere, dreaming always of a greater Texas, and touched by God, but unable because of the law to stand forth as the minister he was, and Father Clooney, the sometimes wavering Roman Catholic priest, who was not wholly accepted by his own church, but who stumbled along, fortified by his love of Jesus Christ, and his compassion for souls wandering in the Texas wilderness. They were ill-matched. Harrison had more vigor and a much deeper conviction that what he was doing represented the drift of history and the will of Jesus Christ. Father Clooney was older, wiser, better educated, and fortified by a church that had existed for 1,800 years. One important characteristic was shared in common. Both clerics aspired to do what was best for Texas, which they saw as one of the brightest hopes in North America or in the world. Very carefully, the priest asked Harrison, "You say you cannot accept this excellent new law?" "Not if it makes me pay for the support of a religion I cannot trust." Clooney did not flinch at this harsh dismissal. "Reverend Harrison, yes, I've known since the day you started holding these secret meetings who you were and what your interests were. Have I tried to interrupt your preaching? Have I put the soldiers to arresting you, which by law I should have done? Have you and I not survived amiably, and are we not friends this evening? If we trusted each other under that bad old constitution, surely we can do so under this good new one." Harrison and some of his people were stunned by the fact that Father Clooney had knowledge of their affairs, for they realized that they were subject to arrest. And one man asked, What are you going to do now that you know? And Cluny replied, Nothing. I would much rather have in Catholic Tejas people who were good Methodists than rascals who were poor Catholics and poor everything else. Friends, and here his voice broke, we are striving to build in Tejas a new society, a strong one, a decent one. We cannot accomplish this if we are at each other's throat, and you cannot find the security you yearn for if you reject this new constitution. His urgent words struck a deep chord in Jubal Quimper's heart. If the new law gives us everything we want except religious freedom, I say let's accept it, because in the long run the press of people moving into Tejas will make it Protestant. Unwisely, he looked at Father Cluny, expecting the priest to confirm this probability. But this the old man could not do. The new law says that Mexico is a Catholic nation. Up here, at the edge of government, it doesn't seem that way. But from San Antonio south, you will travel many days before you find a Protestant. Of course Mexico is Catholic, and of course it must remain so. But the good Catholics of that nation will continue to govern Texas much as they do now. You will enjoy respect and the ordinary freedoms. I do not believe it, Reverend Harrison snapped. Mark my words, we shall see Mexican troops along this river, coming here to enforce Catholicism and to put down Christianity. What a terrible error in words, Father Cluny said instantly. No religion monopolizes Christianity. Catholicism tries to, Harrison snapped, and the meeting ended. Many participants, in later years when some of the issues thus raised had been settled, wrote accounts of this famous confrontation, and one almost illiterate farmer summarized it best. We had met at Quimper's Ferry to pray, and bad luck trailed us, for Father Cluny the Papist found us out and threatened to arrest us for our unlawful prayers. Reverend Harrison debated with him, and we went home, hopeful for the days ahead, because the new laws of Mexico sounded good, but fearful of the years ahead, because we believed that Reverend Harrison was right, and that Texas would soon have to fight for her very existence. Promulgation of the reassuring Constitution of 1824 had a curious aftermath. Hopeful newcomers like Jubal Quimper were now encouraged to think of themselves as Mexicans, citizens of a liberal democracy not unlike that in the United States, and then began to refer to themselves as Texicans, a fortunate verbal invention. Stands to reason, Jubal told Mattie. If they are Mexicans south of the Rio Grande, we ought to be Texicans north of it. And it was by this strong, musical name that they knew themselves. Bathed in euphoria, the Texicans forgot Reverend Harrison's prediction that they would soon be fighting for their existence. But in 1825 that prophecy came true. The enemy, however, was not Mexico. The remaining Karankawa decided they had no chance of living as they had in the past unless they exterminated the white men who had intruded upon their historic territory. Intent upon defending themselves, they launched a series of raids so savage, so cruel in their extermination of lonely cabins and unprotected women, that the settlers had no alternative but to fight back. Kill them now or perish later, was the mood at San Felipe, as the settlers prepared for what they prayed would be the final battle. One group of volunteers assembled at Quimper's Ferry, then marched south, where it would join men gathering along the coast. Since boys above the age of 10 were expected to join the expedition with their own guns, Yancey, now aged 13, reported, and as the Avengers approached the coast, he felt his excitement mounting, for he was eager to perform well. But when they had sneaked close to one Karankawa settlement, a cluster of movable ba'aks or tepees, and the time came for battle action, he froze, as he had when confronted by the rattlesnake. and while those about him decimated this first contingent of Indians with a surprise volley, then exterminated them in the wild follow-up, he stood transfixed at the bloody killing. "We wiped them out," the volunteers shouted, as scouts advised them where to head in order to trap the next group of Kronks. Two men who had seen Yancey's craven behavior walked with him, offering advice. "When the firing starts, don't listen to the noise, and never look at the Indians as human beings. You're shooting squirrels, that's all. You've shot squirrels, ain't you?" When Yancey said he had not, the men said, "Well, you're going to shoot something much better than squirrels tomorrow. You keep with us. We'll show you." That night, the Quimper's Ferry people were overtaken by a late contingent from the Trinity, and foremost in that group was Reverend Harrison, who conducted services in the darkness, assuring the Avengers that they were doing God's work in removing the Indian menace from this part of Texas. "We shall always face an Indian enemy wherever we move in Texas, and we shall enjoy no peace till we exterminate him." When two men from the Ferry region, who had not known the minister before, asked, "You think the battle against them will go on forever?" he replied, "The fight for goodness never ceases. Our grandchildren will be fighting Indians." On the next day, at about noon, the last great battle against the Karankawa took place, and these proud Indians, for centuries the lords of the Three Rivers, and the scourge of those lesser tribes who tried to infiltrate, realized that their sunset was upon them, and they fought with terrible valor, one brave driving alone at the heart of the White Army, coming on and on until he arrived at the mouth of the guns with only a broken stave in his hand. "Irk! Arg!" he shouted in meaningless syllables, trying to grasp with his bare hand the rifle barrels whose fiery discharges tore him apart. In terrible struggle, the mighty Karankawa died. Braves, old men, women, little girls, boys defying the rifles. A notable tribe endeavored to protect its homeland and failed. Toward evening, a pitiful remnant fighting on the far edge of the encounter rallied under the leadership of two heroic warriors to break through the encircling ranks of white men. Signaling to other survivors, women and children alike, these few started a long retreat south toward refuge across the Rio Grande. And after harrowing days without food or water, they vanished, except for a few stragglers, from the soil of Texas, to be known no more except in fabled stories about them Kronks who ate people. They went in sorrow and defeat, the first of more than 40 Indian tribes who would be banished from Texas, until the triumphant whites could boast, "We ain't got no Indians in Texas. We couldn't abide 'em." Sister American states would devise ways whereby the Indian and the white man could live together, not wholesome ways, nor sensible, but the citizens of Texas could not. The antipathies were too strong. Yancey did not distinguish himself in this final battle, for as before, the sound of gunfire immobilized him, and he could only watch as the struggle evolved. At one point in the battle, a Karankawa dashed right past him, not 15 feet away, and one of Yancey's counselors bellowed, "Fire, goddammit, fire!" But Yancey was unable to do so. However, on the way home, when he marched with other men, he began to talk about his heroics among the Karankawa, so that by the time he reached the ferry, he had convinced himself that he had behaved with more than average bravery. And when he was close to the family dog run, he told his companions, "You know, there's a Kronk who moves about here now and then." And this so excited the victorious Texicans that when they suddenly saw before them the Kronk, they unhesitatingly slew him, the last Karankawa the Brazos would ever see. Mattie was appalled by this gratuitous slaughter, but when she confronted the killers, they said honestly, "Yance never told us he was tame." and she deduced the criminal part her son had played in this assassination. She did not chastise him for this terrible act, but on succeeding days, as she sat on her porch at dusk, exhausted by the multiple tasks she was required to perform while Jubal was out hunting meat or searching for honey trees, she realized how severe her loss was in the death of the Krunk. He had been a member of the family, their custodian, their watchman, the one who stepped forward when there was work to do, the one with whom she talked when the men were away and she faced long days of work. Painfully, this savage Indian had made the transition to civilization, and in the end, that civilization had destroyed him, for no reason except that he was an Indian. On the third evening, when she appreciated most clearly the dreadful loss she had sustained, and the reasons for it, she began to weep. Not for the Krunk, whose days of confusion were over, but for all those who ventured into a strange land or encountered strange responsibilities, and the sorrow of civilization was almost more than she could bear. She wanted no more of war, no more of argument between Catholic and Protestant, no more confrontation between Mexico and the American states. She wanted only to operate her ferry, run her inn, feed the traveler, and save enough money to buy a new dress at the store in San Felipe, or perhaps some extra forks and spoons. But most of all, she prayed in her desolation that her son would somehow or other grow into manhood with the capacity to meet a man's obligations. No American settler since the Revolution of 1776 had faced the nagging moral problems encountered by those citizens of the Republic who moved into Texas in the period of 1820 to 1835. And none faced the confusions with more vacillating reactions than Jubal Quimper. Even those later settlers who would cross an entire continent to build new homes in California or Oregon would have the reassurance that in moving from one part of the United States to another, they would carry their religion, their language, and their customary law with them. But when people like the Quimpers emigrated to Texas, they surrendered such assurances, placing themselves under the constraints of a new religion, a new language, and a much different system of law. Facing these complexities, Matty and Jubal followed one simple rule. Whatever Stephen F. Austin decides is probably right. Like many others, they revered the strange little man, forgiving him his arbitrary manner. Matty especially realized that there was a good deal wrong with Austin. Why has he never married? Is he afraid of women? And why does he stare at you with those fixed eyes like a hawk? All he can think of is his colony. But despite his faults, and they were many, she saw him as the reliable guide, and whenever he stopped at her inn during his travels throughout the colony, she nodded approval to what he told the visitors who dropped by to talk politics with him. Gentlemen, Tejas will not only live under this new Mexican Constitution of 1824, it will prosper. Aren't there weaknesses in it? A farmer asked, and Austin snapped, There are weaknesses in every document drawn by the human mind. Our new law has certain peculiarities reflecting Mexican custom, but they will not impinge upon our freedom. Tejas is to be a Catholic state, but we've seen how easily we live under that constraint. And yes, priests and soldiers will be tried in courts manned only by their own people, but that's always been the case, and we haven't suffered. Are you satisfied? A settler from Alabama asked bluntly, to live under Mexican law for the rest of your life? And Austin answered, I am. Jubal Quimper, usually agreeing with whoever spoke to him last, grasped Austin's hands and said, Mr. Austin, I'll stand beside you as a Mexican citizen, permanent. But some days after Austin departed with his pledge of allegiance from the people at Quimper's Ferry, a copy of the new Constitution arrived, and the man from Alabama, who had interrogated Austin, rushed to the inn, waving the paper in the air. "Good God! Listen to what this document says!" And he asked Quimper to read the offending passage. "With the adoption of this constitution, slavery is forbidden throughout Texas, and 6 months from this date, even the importation of slaves already on their way to Texas will be outlawed." Neighbors quickly gathered, and thus began one of the insoluble contradictions of Texas history. Of 100 families like the Quimpers, not more than 15 owned slaves, which meant that the vast majority could have had no financial interest in preserving slavery. Yet most of those without slaves defended the institution and seemed ready to battle Saltillo to preserve it. Jubal and Matty were representative. "We never had no slaves in Tennessee and didn't know many people who did. Lord knows we don't have any to share our work here in Texas. But it stands to reason. It says right in the Bible that the sons of Ham shall be hewers of wood and drawers of water, and that's the way it's got to be." Matty, who befriended everyone, even Karankawa, was especially strong in her condemnation of the proposed law. "Niggers ain't really human. I don't yearn to own none, but those good folks who bring 'em here ought to be protected in their property." This question so agitated the settlers that a delegation of 3 planters, led by Jubal Quimper, went resolutely down to Austin's headquarters and told him bluntly, "Our liberties must be preserved." And with that simple statement arose the tantalizing ethical issue which would plague Texas for decades, because good-hearted men like Jubal Quimper honestly believed that their freedom could be ensured only by the right to enslave others. Austin, perceiving the moral wrong in this position, laid bare his honest feelings. "Gentlemen, I tell you frankly that I oppose slavery with every fiber of my body, now and forever. I condemn it 4 times. It's bad for society in general. It's bad for commerce, and bad for both master and slave. Never have I departed from this belief, and never shall I. The wise men in Saltillo who framed our Constitution knew what they were doing, and they did it well. Slavery should be outlawed." There could have been no statement of principle more unequivocal than that, and it persuaded Quimper, who spoke for the others. "You're right, Stephen. What we need is a whole new start. No masters, no slaves." But no sooner had Quimper renewed his support than an extraordinary reversal occurred. For that night, Austin began to review the problem, not according to his personal convictions, but according to his role as leader of a tentative colony not yet securely based, and the more he studied reality, the more convinced he became that Texas had little chance of survival if it failed to attract hundreds or even thousands of established Southern gentlemen who would bring with them prosperity and culture. In an open meeting next morning, he attacked the philosophical problem first. "Gentlemen, order, order. I do not derogate the great states of Kentucky and Tennessee, from which many of our finest settlers have come, nor do I speak against any man standing here. But I have become painfully aware that our colony can progress only if we attract in large numbers families of wealth, high cultural attainment, and sound moral training from our educated southern states like Virginia, Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. When they join us with their books, their wealth, and their long experience in trade, they will make Texas a state of which we shall be proud." There was a long silence, while the inescapable truth of what he had said was judged. And then Quimper cried, "You're right, Stephen. We need schoolteachers and men who know the Bible." While many nodded and some whispered, Austin waited, almost afraid to point out the consequences of what he had just said. But finally he summoned courage and spoke. "Such men will not join us if they cannot bring their slaves. What white man could grow sugarcane in our steaming river bottoms? What white man from Alabama could toil under our blazing sun, chopping cotton, then pick it, then haul it to the gin. Only Negroes can do such work, and slavery seems to be the pattern ordained by God for handling them. It is clear that Tejas must have slavery or perish. So Jubal Quimper and a committee of seven, only one of whom owns slaves, helped Austin draft an appeal to the state government in Saltillo and the national government in Mexico City, explaining that, whereas the abolishment of slavery was unquestionably right for the rest of the nation, it was not appropriate at this time in a frontier region like Tejas. We cannot work our fields without slaves, and we cannot populate our empty spaces unless men of property from the southern states of America are permitted to bring their slaves with them. Austin, a man who hated slavery, had become its champion. During the trip back home, Quimper reviewed the sudden shifts of their leader. First, he was stern morality. Slavery must be abolished. Then he was all for the South. They must be allowed to bring in their slaves. I wonder where he really stands. Matter of fact, I wonder where I stand. This moral confusion on the part of Austin and his adherents would continue, for when Austin concocted a dream for enticing thousands of German and Swiss settlers, he became an ardent opponent of slavery, in deference to their known dislike for keeping anyone in bondage. The possibility of such a country as Tejas being overrun by a slave population almost makes me weep. Slavery is an injustice and a demoralizing agent in society. When I started this colony, I was forced to tolerate it for a while, because I had to draw upon the slave states for my immigrants. But slavery is now most positively prohibited by our Mexican Constitution, and I hope it may always be so, for it is a curse of the curses and one of the worst reproaches of civilized man. But later he would be forced once more to consider the realities of settlement, and again he would reverse himself completely. I used to oppose slavery, but during the last 6 months I have had to re-study the matter, and now conclude that Texas must be a slave country. Circumstances and unavoidable necessity compel it. It is the wish of the people, and I shall do all I can prudently in favor of it. I will do so. Quimper, listening to this speech, noticed that Austin had dropped the Spanish Tejas in favor of the English Texas, indicating serious doubt that his colony could long remain with Mexico, which he also now pronounced in the American fashion. Never again would his friends hear him use the Spanish names, which he had tried so faithfully to defend, but which he now abandoned forever. Jubal's attention to such heady political matters was diverted in late 1828 by an exciting letter from his former lawyer in Gallatin, Tennessee. "Jubal, I send you great news. Your persecutor, Hammond Carver, was killed in a duel, and this legally terminates his case against you. I have ascertained from his survivors that they have no intention of resurrecting the suit, and they have acknowledged in writing that the contested land is yours, along with all the buildings on it. You find yourself not a rich man, but one with ample fields and some money, which you can claim only by coming here in person. Do so immediately, for you and Matty have many friends in these parts, who are eager to see you resume your life among them." This heaven-sent opportunity to escape the tensions of a frontier Texas made Jubal realize how much he longed for the stability of a settled Tennessee, and he was ready to depart immediately. "Matty, we're free to go home." She deflated his enthusiasm by saying with bulldog stubbornness, "I have no wish to see Tennessee again." And he began placing before her all the reasons why they should return to the pleasant life that they could now have in Gallatin. "Arthur says we won't be really rich, but we'll have enough to buy us a couple of slaves." You won't have to worry about the ferry, and we won't have strangers traipsing into our home. More important, we can have real walls and windows." He threw at her an impressive summary of the differences between civilized Tennessee and barbarian Texas. But in the end, she countered with an incontestable reply. "I like it here." And in fragmentary comments, she let him and Yancey know how deeply Texas had infected her. "Nothing I saw in Tennessee is better than that clump of oak trees in the meadow." During another debate, she said, "I like the Brazos, the way it rises and falls, like it had a will of its own." On a different day, she said, "My heart beats faster when a stranger comes to the door at night needing food, and we have it." And finally, "Like a rock gathering moss, I've allowed Texas to grow over me, and I admire the feel." Guarding each word, she said, "You and Yancey can go back and settle the claim, and if you're so minded, you can stay. I'll give you your freedom, in the courts if you wish. But this is now my home, and I expect to end my days running my ferry." The force of her statement made Jubal pause. Twice he started to speak, but could find no words. Then abruptly he turned away and went to walk beneath the oak trees that Mattie loved so deeply. And as he tried to see their new home through her eyes, he began to appreciate why she loved Texas and was so unwilling to leave it. After more than an hour of walking along the Brazos, he returned to his wife and took her in his arms. "Mattie, old girl, if this is your home, it'll be mine, too. I could never leave you, because I know how often it was you held me upright." She cherished his embrace, but did not wish to impede him. "If your heart's set on Tennessee..." "Hush. I'll go back, sell the land, and buy some lumber in New Orleans. I'm going to build you a proper house." With this commitment, from which he would never deviate, Jubal Quimper became a Texican. That day, Mattie, with a song trembling on her lips, started to pack the goods her two men would require for their long trip. But her work was interrupted by Yancey, who came whispering, "I don't want to go, Indians and that strip and all." And she could guess that what really held him back was his memory of that fistfight with the smaller boy. "What will happen to him?" she asked herself. "A boy who refuses a journey up the Mississippi." She had finished packing when a cloud of dust appeared from the south. Benito Garza was on his way to New Orleans with another convoy of mules for the American army. He was 22 now, a slim, neat fellow with a small mustache, an ingratiating smile, and a fair command of English. "This time I take the mules myself. I do not need guide or trader from San Antonio." He had brought with him a Mexican boy, no more than 14, and a large remuda of some 36 mules, which he hoped to augment as he moved north. "I like to buy any mules you might have, Señor Quimper." When Jubal said he had none, Garza asked, "Is it true, Señor? You're going to Tennessee?" "I must." "A town on the Mississippi?" "It's a state, like Coahuila y Texas." "But it is on the Mississippi?" When Quimper nodded, the ebullient young man slapped himself on the knee and cried, "Then you must come with us. Save time, save money. Catch a steamboat up the river." And he worked his arms like the pistons of a riverboat, spouting imaginary steam with his mouth and sounding a whistle. Mattie was enthusiastic about such a plan and tried to persuade her son, now 16, to go along. "You can help manage the mules, and you'll see the steamboat." But he still refused to go, not wishing to take such risks. The two men left in October and wandered up the Goliad Road with some 50 mules, adding to them at the Trinity, and then keeping to the southernmost route along the Gulf till they crossed the Sabine into Louisiana. There they found tolerable roads leading to New Orleans, where Jubal stayed in Mexican lodgings with his two companions. He told Garza, as the latter dickered with the American authorities over the prices of his mules, "Benito, I'd enjoy traveling with you some time again. You know how to move about." And Garza said, "You'd be welcome. I need to practice English if so many of you are coming to Texas." "You must, because I'm telling you, I'm warning you, really. Texas won't be Mexican forever." "I think it will be," Garza said. And when they were back in their mean quarters, he asked Quimper, "How long, senor, have you been in Texas?" And Quimper thought a moment, then said, 6 years. And Garza laughed. "Senor, and you're telling me who is to run Texas? My people explored Texas 300 years ago." Quimper considered this, then said with no rancor, "Amigo, that may have ensured you a foothold in what you call Texas, but in the Texas that's coming, you better speak like an American and think like one, or you're going to be homeless." And the young man snapped, "Garza's will be living here when you've run back to Tennessee." The only thing about Garza that Quimper did not like was this quickness at resenting whatever the young man interpreted as an insult to his Hispanic heritage. "If you're going to live in a white man's state, Benito, you mustn't be so touchy." "But I am a white man, and Texas is my state." Quimper let the matter drop, for he no longer tried to understand how the Hispanic mind worked. When Quimper left the Mississippi riverboat at Memphis and started overland to Nashville, he experienced several moments of solemn discovery. Tennessee is so cramped compared to Texas. A man can hardly breathe, hemmed in by all these trees. He did enjoy the snug little towns and the orderly plantations manned by slaves, but repeatedly he caught himself longing for the Brazos and the great open freedom of Texas. "I'll sell the land and get back home." He spent his first 2 weeks in Nashville listening to talk about those events which had occurred since his hasty departure in 1822. "We got ourselves a great new governor, Sam Houston. Him as fought with Andy Jackson against the Indians at Horseshoe Bend. Strong man, strong ideas, outstanding patriot. Going to be president of the United States one of these days." Wherever he moved, he heard good reports of Houston. "Big man, you know. Brave, too. Lived among the Indians. Speaks their language, I'm told. Taller than that post, I'd judge." "How did he become governor?" "Oh, he was a military hero. General Jackson thought very highly of him, and that helped him get elected to the Congress in Washington." "How many terms did he serve, Jake? 3? 2, Jake said. "Could have been elected permanent or senator either, but we wanted him for governor, and with Andy Jackson's help, we got him." Quimper had no opportunity to see Houston in Nashville, for men explained that the governor had business to the east. "You know, he's standing for re-election this year. Foolish for anyone to run against him. Most popular man in the state." By the time Quimper left Nashville for the short trip to Gallatin, he had heard so much about Houston that he said on his last night in town, "He's the kind of man we could use in Texas." But his fellow diners dismissed the idea. "His home's in Tennessee. Hell, he is Tennessee." When Quimper arrived in his old hometown of Gallatin, he heard only one topic of conversation. "Little Eliza Allen of our town, she's going to marry the governor tomorrow." Since the Allens were among the leading citizens in Gallatin, Jubal did not know them socially. But he was pleased to think that if the wedding was public, he would have a chance to see and perhaps even meet Sam Houston. The celebrations took place in January 1829, and they were a sumptuous affair, for not often did a small town like Gallatin find one of its daughters marrying the governor of a state, a man certain to be re-elected, and after a term or two in the federal Senate, perhaps be elected to the presidency. Several score of guests rode out from Nashville, and others came long distances from the eastern part of the state, where Houston had once lived. He was a rising star with whom politicians of all stripes wished to be associated. And when Quimper saw him, a giant of a man, and holding on to his arm a delicate little woman dressed in white with just a touch of pink in her ribbons, he was awed. "He looks like a governor. He looks like a Texican. I was right when I said we could use him." When the wedding was solemnized in high form, Quimper found himself thinking, "Not much like the mass unions that Father Clooney celebrates," and he felt a longing for that simpler life. "I know what Mattie meant. I couldn't live here in Gallatin after that free life on the rivers." But such thoughts were expelled that night, when at about 10, the men of town were nicely inebriated, and someone shouted, "Let's give the governor and his lady a real chivalry." Nearly 100 drunks assembled outside the tavern with horns and drums and washboards and bugles and tin pots. Led by one of Eliza's cousins, the crowd surged along the streets, gathering recruits, until it reached the small house in which the governor and Eliza were spending their first night together. There, a noise was generated which had not been matched since the explosion of a powder depot some years before. Horns blared, men bellowed, drums were banged, and the night was made raucous with a serenade whose tradition dated back 2,000 years. A marriage was being launched, and the community wished to mark this mystical occasion, not only with prayers, but also with riotous celebration. And when two men came up with a barrel of whiskey on wheels, the noise really began. It was a chivalry honoring a great and much-loved man, a man of dignity and power, and all who shattered the night did so in hopes that somehow their destiny would be matched to his. But it was also a serenade to a gentlewoman whom the town loved. And after a while, the men started a chant. "Eliza, Eliza, the world's fairest flower, Eliza, Eliza, pray come to my bower." It was well after 2 in the morning before the barrel was empty and the tin pots beaten beyond recognition. Then off to their beds straggled the celebrants, except those who returned to the taverns, banging on the doors and demanding admittance. Quimper, remaining in the streets through the night, judged that he had never participated in a better chivalry, and he doubted that anyone else had either. A few days later, Jubal found an opportunity to talk with Houston. "Governor, I've cast my lot with Texas, and I can see that you're the kind of man we need down there to pull things together before we join the Union." Houston, afraid that this might be a trap, seducing him into some impropriety, said easily, "Now, sir, I can tell you that I've always thought well of that part of Mexico. In 1822, I applied for a land grant down there. Can't remember whether I ever received the papers or not, but I know it's a splendid territory. You have a dazzling future, Governor, Texas or wherever." The big man appreciated such flattery and accepted it gracefully. "My future's twofold: to build a proper house for my wife, and to get re-elected governor of this great state. That's enough to keep me busy." The next day, Quimper was startled to see Governor Houston striding through town in his favorite costume: Indian garb, sandals, buckskin breeches, with a bright red shawl draped about his shoulders. "What's he doing?" Jubal asked a bystander, and the man snorted, "Keep watching. You'll see wonders." And on subsequent days, Houston appeared in 3 radically different costumes, none appropriate to his high office. Finally, Jubal had to comment, "Governor, you seem to like unusual dress." To which Houston replied, "I dress like the land, different seasons, different colors." And then, on the 16th of April, in that first year of marriage, Gallatin and all of Tennessee were stunned by the news that the delicate and lovely Eliza Allen Houston had, for some mysterious reason never to be revealed, left the governor's bed and board, telling her family that she could never return. "Impossible," the men in the taverns cried, while their wives at home met secretly to explore in hushed conversation the devastating possibilities. That Eliza's abrupt behavior must have had some dark sexual cause, there could be no doubt. And since specifically what it had been would never be disclosed, speculation was not only invited, but also inventive. The scandal was intensified when the governor announced that he must, out of respect to his constituency, refuse to stand for re-election. And when his friends implored him not to take such drastic action, he shocked them completely by resigning the balance of the term to which he was already entitled. While they fumed, he boarded a steamer and sailed into lonely exile among the Indians he had known previously. Rarely in American history had a man who had risen so high fallen so low. His precipitate departure raised far more questions than it answered, for in the silence surrounding the case, his partisans launched an explanation, totally unauthorized, which cleared his name. But this could be circulated only at the expense of Eliza Allen, whose irate family had no intention of allowing her to shoulder the blame for this destruction of Houston's career. So, in self-defense, the male members of the Allen family engineered a solution unique in American political life. They nominated a panel of 12 sober citizens of impeccable repute to hold a series of public meetings, the more salacious details kept private, to apportion blame in this affair. At the conclusion, a vote would be taken, and a determination made as to whether Eliza Allen of Gallatin was or was not guilty, in even the slightest degree, in the scandalous affair of Governor Sam Houston. When 11 Solons had been selected, military heroes, lawyers, clergymen, bankers, one Leonidas Allen, a relative of the abused wife, suggested, "I'm glad to see this fellow Quimper back among us. He's become a man of sober judgment, reputation restored by the courts. I'd like to see him stay here. Let's signify our acceptance by inviting him to serve on our jury." No member of the committee listened to the evidence with closer attention than Quimper, and when the time came for the first crucial vote, he experienced no uncertainty. The question was clearly stated. Was Eliza Allen, at the time of her marriage to Governor Houston, a virgin? The vote was 11-1 affirmative. And as soon as the man who voted nay was known, one of the colonels challenged him to a duel on the grounds that he had impugned the reputation of a gentlewoman. But the voter justified himself by explaining that he was a lawyer from Virginia, who felt that the question as stated could not be answered, since substantive evidence had not been provided. The colonel accepted the apology, the challenge was withdrawn, and the ashen-faced Virginian, aware of how close he had come to being shot, begged permission to alter his vote to affirmative, and when the balloting was announced, Eliza was unanimously found to have been a virgin. Each of the other possible charges against her was analyzed similarly, and in vote after vote, the correctness of her behavior was sustained. When the final tally was made, it was clear that Eliza's reputation had been not only cleared but also burnished. By the 12 ablest men in Gallatin, she was found to have been immaculate in both behavior and spirit. At the conclusion of the investigation, two members of the panel composed a stirring document in which Eliza's purity was extolled and the governor's lack of it deplored. It covered all the debatable points and indicated the jury's vote on each, and it ended with an exhortation to the journals of Tennessee and surrounding states that they give the fullest possible coverage to the voting. But the Virginia lawyer, already frightened by what might have happened as a consequence of that first vote, now advised the committee that, whereas the report accurately summarized their debate, and while its decisions were irrefutable, it might be wise to delay publication until the jury could be sure that Sam Houston had left the state. After prudent delay, the report was circulated, and interested newspapers did publish it. But by then, Houston was lost in the wilds of Arkansas, living among his beloved Indians and remaining drunk most of the time. A traveler told Quimper, "Shortly after Houston arrived in Arkansas, I saw him drunk in a saloon, where a local braggart challenged him to a duel. I was standing with Houston when he accepted. Asked me to be his second. So in the morning haze, lengths were stepped off. The two duelists, obviously unsteady, marched, turned, aimed, and fired. Nobody got hit, for the good reason that me and the other man second, realizing that our men were drunk and without any sensible basis for a duel, had loaded the pistols with blanks." While Jubal was still chuckling over this portrait of the former governor, he was confronted by a great temptation. Leonidas Allen, the man who had sponsored his membership on the Houston jury, invited him twice to dinner in the Allen's spacious mansion, and only the most attractive southern hospitality prevailed. But on a third visit, Leonidas took Jubal aside and said in a low voice, "Surely you've noticed that my older sister Clara is quite taken with you." Jubal had not noticed, but when he returned to the company of the ladies, he could not avoid Clara's ardent glances. As he left the mansion, Leonidas whispered, "We would be most honored, Clara and me, that is, if you'd dine with us tomorrow." "Sir, I'm married. I have a wife in Texas." "Things can always be arranged." He spent a feverish night, for with the funds he had received from the settlement, plus those which would accrue to him if he married Miss Clara, who was not at all repulsive, he could own one of the Gallatin mansions. Also, he could hear Mattie saying, "I'll give you your freedom." But as he tossed on his straw mattress, he thought of the Brazos and Stephen Austin trying to build a state, and of Texas reaching empty to the horizon, and of Mattie poling her ferry. Early next morning, he went to a bank, arranged for his new wealth to be posted to a New Orleans agent against whom he could draw when he returned home, and headed for the Mississippi without bidding either Leonidas or Clara farewell. When his boat put into an Arkansas levee, one of the hands cried, "There comes Sam Houston, meets us every trip." And up the gangway came the former governor, already drunk, but looking to the steamboat's bar for replenishment. Jubal, fearing that Houston might have learned about the jury report, hid among the passengers, but stayed close enough to hear Houston haranguing the travelers. "Let's all get off the boat and head cross-country to Oregon. I'm going there as soon as practical." When Houston was safely off the boat and lying immobile beside some cotton bales, Jubal said to a passenger, "Look at him, governor of a state. We don't need his kind in Texas." New Orleans, Natchitoches in Louisiana, Nacogdoches in Texas, El Camino Real, and south along the banks of the Trinity to the Goliad Road, this was the pathway of empire, except that other things besides immigrants traveled it. This autumn, cholera made the journey too, meeting up with Jubal Quimper just before he reached the village on the Trinity in which Reverend Harrison hid, and from which he conducted his forbidden prayer meetings. The two men were glad to see each other, and Harrison sat fascinated as Jubal reported upon the doings in Tennessee. It was Harrison's opinion, delivered from afar, that Governor Houston, a giant of a man, as Quimper reported, must have outraged his gentle wife in some grotesque sexual manner. "Your jury rendered the judgment he deserved. You did the work of the Lord." On the second day of the visit, Quimper fell into a fit of such violent shaking that the preacher cried, "Dear God, Jubal, you must have the plague." And as soon as these dire words were spoken, they were flashed throughout the small community, and the minister's house was quarantined. It was a useless gesture, because by that night, four other cases of extreme ague had been identified, and by morning it was clear that the Trinity River had received, from some mysterious source, perhaps from Jubal Quimper himself via New Orleans, its latest attack of this dread disease. Called alternately the plague, or cholera, or the vomiting shakes, or simply the fever, it assaulted the human body so furiously and with such total destruction that the victim rarely survived 3 full days. And that was the case with Quimper. Reverend Harrison, ignoring the pleas of his secret parishioners that he dissociate himself from the stricken man, said, "If Jesus Christ could medicine the lepers, I can medicine Quimper." And he remained with Jubal, cooling his fevered face with damp towels, until convulsive seizures showed that death was imminent. Beloved brother in Christ, Jesus awaits thee in heaven. May the merciful God stay this plague, and may the earth be made whole again. In the last minutes, he bathed the dying man's face once more, praying frantically as if to finish his beseeching before his friend died. Dear God, take into your bosom this traveler. On earth he tried to do your bidding. In heaven he will grace your throne. When Quimper died, Harrison closed the eyelids and arranged the sweat-drenched bedclothes. Then he left his house. But others in the village were afraid to move near him. Quimper's clothes had to be burned, of course, but a few durable possessions like coins remained, and these the minister gathered, proposing to carry them the 60 miles to Quimper's ferry. For he felt that it would be improper for Mattie to learn of her husband's sudden death from strangers. He was delayed, however, by the necessity of burying 4 others who had fallen to the plague, and when this was finished, he wondered whether it was proper for him to move into another community, lest he carry the cholera with him. Waiting 6 days, he concluded that he was not going to be stricken. So down the Goliad Road he went on his mission of compassion. As he neared the ferry, he wondered how he should speak to Mattie, for her husband had been far too young to die. But even when he stood at the pole that carried the flag travelers were instructed by a signboard to raise if they wanted the ferry to fetch them, he was undecided. He heard young Yancey shouting, "Mom, the ferry!" And he wondered why this growing boy did not himself come across to get him. But since Yancey did not, Mattie appeared, wiping her hands on her apron and heading for the heavy pole. With the skill acquired from many crossings, she brought the raft to its landing and shouted, "Welcome, Pastor. Jubal will be coming home any time now." When he climbed into the ferry, he sat silent for so long that Mattie asked abruptly, "What is it, Reverend? Bad news?" And he said simply, "Jubal died. Cholera." She did not interrupt her poling. Pushing the heavy post into the bottom mud, she walked along the edge of her craft, shoving the ferry forward, then dragging the pole in the water as she strode forward to push once more. Working and keeping her eyes upon the swirling water, she said nothing till she brought her craft home safely to its resting place. Then, helping the minister to negotiate the steep bank, she said, "Father Clooney's here. 6 weddings set for this afternoon." They walked to the dog run, where the priest was sitting in the shade at the far end of the porch. "Hello, Reverend," he said. And Harrison replied, "I bring heavy news. Jubal, the plague." Father Clooney had helped bury many plague victims, but never could he adjust to the incredible swiftness with which this terrible malady struck. And to have it take a man to whom he, Clooney, was so much indebted was a burden trebly heavy. "Let us not tell the others," he suggested. "It's their wedding." So the 3 agreed that not even Yancey would be told until after the ceremony. "I'll move along," Harrison said. "I couldn't attend the wedding." "You could if you wished," Father Clooney said. He wanted to add, so that Harrison would join, that such weddings were formalities demanded by the Mexican government, but he could not frame the words. No wedding was a formality, not any, not under any conceivable circumstances. Harrison, unwilling to participate in or bear witness to such an improper mixture of politics and faith, moved sullenly away. But Cluny, on the other hand, became more excited and devout as the holy moments approached. Taking a nip now and then to encourage himself, he was feeling at the height of his power by the time the six couples had gathered, and he surprised them by saying with deep solemnity, "Let us gather at the river," and led them to a plateau adorned by oak trees, where the couples could look down 40 feet to the Brazos as it carried mud to the sea. He had not chosen this spot by accident, for when the farmers stood with their brides and their children, he cried in a kind of chant, "When storms strike far inland, that little stream down there can rise in fury and sweep across this land, which seems so safe up here. 40 feet of sudden turbulence, and who can believe that? It will be the same with your marriages. An unexpected storm can overwhelm you, and who would believe that? Wise men and women, when they enter into marriage, do so with some religious blessing, with God's most precious sanction, for they know they need that extra help. If the families of the Brazos did not protect their homes up here, the stormy river would sweep them away. And if you do not call upon God to consecrate your marriages, they too can be swept away. In this solemn moment when you start your new lives, I give you the balm of God's love. I anoint you. I bless you. I give you the gentle kiss of Jesus. Above all, I give you protection against the great storms of life, in life and in death.